The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Today's world news, what it means, where it's taking us.
I bring you the one and only possible message of world peace.
This is a message of hope, tremendous hope. And he said unto me, you must prophesy again.
The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Good morning, everyone. This is Brad McDonald, and I'll be filling in today for Stephen Fleury. In the past week, we've covered the crisis in Greece and the deal between Iran and the U.S. pretty extensively at thetrumpet.com and here on Trumpet Daily Radio. And rightly so, both these are game-changing developments. But today I thought we could talk about two other stories that haven't received as much attention. But these two are noteworthy. They are important, and we need to pay attention. First, I thought we might take a look at some of the recent actions of Pope Francis. As you know, the current Pope is incredibly popular. Since he became pontiff, he's done a lot to restore the reputation of the Catholic Church. And Pope Francis has really emerged as an influential voice in world politics. Most recently, he traveled to Latin America, where he delivered some powerful speeches and endorsed some policies that we haven't seen a pope endorse, at least in recent history. To begin with, I thought I'd read an article that was written by Paul Farrell in Market Watch yesterday. And the title of that article is Pope Francis Ignites a Revolt That Will Overthrow American Capitalism. And the author really makes some dramatic points about Pope Francis and the message coming from the Vatican. Farrell writes, yes, Pope Francis is encouraging civil disobedience, leading a rebellion. Listen closely. Francis knows he's inciting political rebellion, an uprising of the masses against the world's super-rich capitalists. Further down, Farrell writes, warning, forget Bernie versus Hillary. Forget the circus clown car distractions created by Trump versus the GOP's Fab 15. Pope Francis is the only real political leader that matters this year. Forget the rest. So he just makes the point that Pope Francis is emerging as the superstar in world politics. He's traveling around the world delivering speeches, and he's delivering speeches that really are a direct attack on U.S.-style capitalism. Pope Francis is a superstar, and he has the attention of the world citizens. Farrell continues, Pope Francis is not just leading a second American revolution. He is rallying people across the earth, middle class as well as poor, inciting billions to rise up in a global economic revolution, one that could suddenly sweep the planet, like the 1789 French storming of the Bastille. I mean, the Pope is following a strategy to marshal people around the world and have them rise up against rich capitalists. Farrell continues, the fact is, the era of capitalism is rapidly dying, a victim of its own success, sabotaged by greed and a loss of a moral code. And he just makes the point that there's just a growing resentment and bitterness for the wealthy, for the billionaires of the world, and for the big banks and for the big corporations. He continues, in the generation since the Reagan Revolution, America's self-centered, consumer-driven, mutant capitalism lost its moral compass, drifting. Inequality explodes, income growth stagnates, the poor keep getting poorer. Yet across the world, billionaires have exploded. In the year 2000, there were 322 billionaires on the planet. In 2015, we have 1,826 billionaires on the planet. Farrell continues, but not for much longer. As Pope Francis's revolution accelerates, as his relentless socialist message of sacred rights for all people makes clear. And then he goes on to quote the Pope, who has made some really remarkable statements about our capitalist system. Farrell continues, an aggressive Pope Francis is on a mission to transform the mutant ideology of today's capitalist world with its rampant profit-centered climate science denialism. Pope Francis's recent trip to South America revealed a clear anti-capitalism, socialist message calling, and then he quotes the Pope as calling for a structural change to a global economy that runs counter to the plan of Jesus. And the Pope is right in so many ways. Western-style capitalist economic systems, they are broken, and they are motivated by greed and vanity, and they are run by, you know, big corporations and big banks like Goldman Sachs, who are dishonest and greedy. America's capitalist economy, it is broken. But does the Pope have a good solution? Is he endorsing a right solution? Is he endorsing a solution that's going to bring stability and happiness and peace and tranquility? This is what the Pope said in Bolivia. He said, the future of humanity does not lie solely in the hands of great leaders, the great powers, and the elites. The future of humanity is fundamentally in the hands of peoples and in their ability to organize. It is in their hands which can guide with humility and conviction this process of change. I am with you. I am with you, the Pope said. When this man speaks, millions of people listen. And here recently in Bolivia, he told the people, I'll read that again. It is future of humanity is fundamentally in the hands of peoples and in their ability to organize. What does he mean by organize? Well, he's talking about the masses protesting. He's talking about the masses coming together and revolting against the authorities, the national authorities. I mean, you could perceive that statement as a call to arms. I mean, it's an endorsement of unrest. It's an endorsement of protests. He's invoking, he's encouraging peoples around the world to rise up and to protest, to revolt against the capitalist economies, against their leadership. Farrell, the author of this article, he continues, yes, folks, Pope Francis is a revolutionary destined to end up in the history books, right up there with Lenin and Marx, Mao and Castro. He is obviously inciting revolution, wants civil disobedience and political insurrection. He is egging the poor into rebellion against a vastly outnumbered rich. Again, man's system is flawed. The financial and economic systems we see around this world, especially in the Western world, they are flawed. They're broken. But is the solution that the Pope is promoting, is that the solution? This is what Farrell says. In fact, Francis has become one of the world's great revolutionary leaders. He not only is inciting an uprising of the masses against wealthy capitalist billionaires, he's out in front of the emerging global revolution, encouraging the masses, shouting battle cries, a leader in the tradition of George Washington. The media should stop mistaking Francis's congenial nature, his perpetual smile, dismissing his true intentions. His is an aggressive call to arms, a call for a global revolution attacking today's out-of-control, consumer-driven mutant capitalism, a call to replace capitalism with a new economic socialism, giving the poor sacred rights on par with the super rich. The Pope is right when he says the systems, financial and political, in the Western world today are broken. He's right about that. But the solution is not global socialism. The solution is not the social doctrine of the Roman Catholic Church. Look at the history of the Roman Catholic Church. Look at Europe during the Middle Ages, when the Roman Catholic Church really was the central authority, morally, religiously, politically. I mean, did Europe prosper? Was Europe a continent of peace and happiness and stability and tranquility? when the Pope's religion was in control? I'll just read a few quotes from an article by Christopher Hale in Time magazine. This was from July 10th. "If it wasn't clear before," Hale says, "it is now. Pope Francis is no moderate. In what some are calling a nearly revolutionary speech, Francis gave a 55-minute papal tour de force in Bolivia Thursday night, calling for a structural change to a global economy that runs counter to the plan of Jesus." You see, Pope Francis and the Vatican want to transform the global economy. They want to upend the global economy. They want to tear it apart and then rebuild it. Hale then notes that same quote that we read from Pope Francis. In this article, Hale lists four fundamental policies of this revolution that the Pope is leading. The first is land, lodging, and labor are sacred rights. And he says, in what is perhaps his boldest claim to date, Pope Francis argued that everyone has a God-given right to have a job, to own land, and to have a home. This, of course, is neither the promise nor goal of current economic systems established in America and around the globe. This also goes well beyond the traditional social teaching of the Catholic Church. Notice that. This goes well beyond the traditional social teaching of the Catholic Church. The second tenet of the Pope's new global system is that people, not profits, must be the center of the global economy. And Hale noted here how the Pope has lambasted unbridled capitalism. And he's called unbridled capitalism as he's called it a subtle dictatorship. He's called capitalism the dung of the devil. Think about that. And think about who he's addressing when he makes these observations about capitalism. Who's he talking to? I mean, he's talking to, first and foremost, the United States of America, the home of capitalism. And he says capitalism is the equivalent of a subtle dictatorship. Capitalism is the dung of the devil. Again, the capitalist system is not perfect. It is flawed. It's desperately flawed. There are major problems, and it needs to be changed. But this is more that. But there's more going on here than. But does the Pope have the solution? Does the Pope know how to make changes that will work to the benefit of everyone? Francis in Latin America, he said, "Let us say no to an economy of exclusion and inequality, where money rules rather than service. That economy kills. That economy excludes. That economy destroys Mother Earth." So he's making a case too there for the environmentalists. But notice that. Let us say no to an economy of exclusion and equality. When people listen to that, they could perceive that as encouragement to rise up and say no, to rise up and protest. The fourth tenet of the Pope's social doctrine says that lasting change must begin from below. And Hale says, the Pope argued that structural change won't be the result from any one political decision. Change from below works, the Pope says, because when people get caught up in the storms of people's lives, they are deeply moved and compelled to act. So it is the Pope's goal to get the masses, to get poor people and even the middle class, to get them out on the streets protesting, causing instability, demanding changes. Now, this is about to get even more interesting later this year when Pope Francis will visit the United States of America. Francis will visit the U.S. in September. And many expect this to be a milestone visit by the pontiff. And the Pope's itinerary for his visit to America is interesting. He arrives stateside on Tuesday, September 22nd. So that's a date that we'll have to watch. And you know, we really need to watch the Pope on this entire 3 or 4 day trip. He arrives in Washington at 4 p.m. on Tuesday, September 22nd. And it's interesting to note where the Pope is coming from. Before he visits America, he will visit Cuba. And there's a message here. For a man of his reputation, little gestures like this matter. And the fact that the Pope is visiting Cuba first, before he stops through America, is significant. He's sending a message to the United States, and he's sending a message to the world. And he's, you know, that message is that, you know, America comes second. America is no longer the superpower that demands precedence. I'm going to visit Cuba, little old Cuba, first, and then I'll stop by America. So the Pope arrives in America Tuesday afternoon, September 22nd. On Wednesday morning, he has a meeting with President Obama at the White House. On Wednesday afternoon, he's going to conduct Mass at the Basilica of the National Shrine of the Immaculate Conception in Washington. And he's going to conduct Mass in Spanish, and only in Spanish, not in English. And again, that reveals who the Pope's audience is. And it's not the only time he's going to speak in Spanish when he visits the United States. So the Pope is going to make, the Pope is trying to appeal to America's Spanish-speaking population, which is mostly Mexicans. He's kind of inserting himself, you could say, into the immigration debate by giving deference to the Mexicans in America. On Thursday, he's going to address the United States Congress. There'll be a joint session. The Senate and Congress will come together to sit at the feet of Pope Francis and listen to what he has to say. This is the first time ever that a pope has been invited to speak before a joint session of the United States Congress. And many expect this to be a milestone speech. And everyone's expecting him to continue his assault on U.S.-style capitalism. And they expect him to continue to endorse an overhaul of the global financial and economic system. By doing this, the Pope is inserting himself into America's upcoming presidential election. In particular, he's going to make life difficult for Republican candidates. It's the Republicans who tend to be more conservative and tougher on issues like immigration and illegal immigration. It's the Republicans who tend to defend free market capitalism. And by coming down on the opposing side of those two issues, Pope Francis is going to make life difficult. I think it was John Boehner who said that even if he disagrees with what the Pope says in his address before the U.S. Congress, he's not going to say anything because he doesn't want to confront the Pope. He doesn't want to be the American politician who disagrees publicly with the most influential and respected man on earth. After his speech before the U.S. Congress, the Pope is going to visit a charity organization in Washington, D.C., and there he's going to visit with migrants at that charity organization and feed them lunch. The next day, on Friday, September 25th, the Pope will travel to New York, where he'll speak before the United Nations and address the United Nations General Assembly. Again, this is another major address, and this is another example of Pope Francis inserting himself into international relations and global politics. He's going to stand before the United Nations and lecture them on what he believes is the solution to the world's problems. Later that day, he's going to visit a school in inner city New York and, you know, speak with inner city kids in New York. On Saturday, he's going to visit Independence Mall. On Sunday, the Pope is going to visit a correctional facility in Philadelphia. He's going to visit a prison, just like President Obama did recently. He really is appealing to the masses. He's appealing to minorities. He's appealing to migrants. He's appealing to inmates And it all looks so positive. It all looks so altruistic. But he's doing that as part of a larger campaign to oppose the capitalist system, to oppose the Western democratic governments. I'll just read one quote from the Washington Post from June 27th. This is what the Washington Post wrote on June 27th, and it's talking about the Pope's upcoming visit to the United States. The schedule is the result of months of lobbying and debate about where the world's most popular faith leader should go, what he should say, and how he should say it. Between his decision to come to the United States from Cuba and to accept the congressional invitation, many see Francis seeking to play a more muscular role in global affairs. So, you know, a few people are picking up on this. A few people can see the leader of the Roman Catholic Church trying to play a more muscular role in world politics, trying to throw his weight around, trying to push his agenda, the Catholic agenda. In nearly every case, particularly when it comes to the United States of America, Pope Francis's policies, Pope Francis's solutions tend to be anti-American. They tend to be anti-capitalist. They tend to condone and endorse the downfall of America as a superpower and the America that its forefathers built. In January, Pope Francis told reporters that it was his goal to one day walk across the U.S.-Mexico border to show support for those who make the trek from Mexico into the United States. I mean, he said that publicly. He wants to show support for those making the trek from Mexico to the United States. He wants to show support for people breaking the law. He wants to show support of a people who are bringing all sorts of problems to America. He wants to show support for America's downfall. I mean, this really is something that we need to be watching. This is what he said in November 2013. As long as the problems of the poor are not radically resolved by rejecting the absolute autonomy of markets and financial speculation, and by attacking the structural causes of inequality, no solution will be found for the world's problems, or, for that matter, any problems. Again, the Pope is right. Capitalism is out of control. And our financial and economic systems, they are broken, and they are unfair. And they are motivated by terrible, terrible greed, and they do cause all kinds of problems. But does the Pope have the solution? Is his solution fair? Is his solution equitable? Is his solution righteous? Will his solution produce the results that we all hope and desire? Well, it hasn't yet. It hasn't yet. His religion had an opportunity for centuries to get it right, to create economic and financial systems that were peaceful and fair and equitable. And it didn't happen. Now, all of this has everything to do with Bible prophecy. In Revelation chapter 17, the Apostle John discusses the behavior of the Catholic Church and the Vatican in the end time. The protagonist of Revelation 17 is a woman, and you can go and read that chapter if you're interested. But the protagonist of Revelation 17 is a woman, and in the Bible, a woman is always a type of a religion or church. But go ahead and study Revelation 17, and you'll see how this woman or this religion that's discussed in Revelation 17, she fellowships with kings and nations. It says that the kings of the earth commit fornication with this religion. She's a global religion. She's famous. Everyone knows who she is. But I just wanted to make note of a couple of things in verses 15 and 16 of Revelation 17. And again, the Apostle John is talking about this woman, this religion. And he said unto me, the waters which you saw where the woman sits, there are peoples and multitudes and nations and tongues. So this woman is, she's adored by many peoples and by different countries and by people of all different languages. Verse 18 is discussing the woman, and it says, and the woman which you saw is that great city which reigns over the kings of the earth. So that's interesting. This religion rules from that great city. What city is that? Well, there's only one great city that's famous for being home to a world or a global religion. That's Rome. But notice that this woman reigns over the kings of the earth. She has a global presence. Revelation 18, verses 3 and 4 talk about how all the nations have drunk the wine from this woman, and the kings of the earth have committed fornication with her. And notice this, and the merchants of the earth are waxed rich through the abundance of her delicacies. The merchants of the earth, there's a distinct financial or economic element to this woman. She promotes an economic system. She has views and policies and beliefs about what kind of financial and economic system should be erected in the world. And Revelation 17 and 18, it's very clear that it's talking about a woman or it's talking about a religion. I mean, we are witnessing this prophecy being fulfilled right now. The Pope is fellowshipping with the kings of the earth. The Pope is selling a financial and economic system that he wants the whole earth to embrace. He's being listened to and embraced by peoples from all sorts of different countries and different languages. He has a powerful global presence, and the Catholic Church has an increasingly powerful global presence, just like Revelation 17 and other prophecies forecast. This really is remarkable. And you know, the trumpet will continue to keep track of the travels and the remarks of Pope Francis and the Vatican. And we'll be around to report on the Pope's trip to America here in September. Okay, we'll take a break and I'll be right back.
This is KPCG-FM, and this is the Trumpet Daily. Herbert Armstrong often said it was more difficult to unlearn an erroneous supposed truth than it is to learn a new truth. Even after 58 years of faithfully serving God, he had not fully and clearly realized the significance of the fact revealed in Genesis 3:22-24 that, in fact, God had closed the Holy Spirit and eternal life to mankind in general until the removal of Satan at the second coming of Jesus Christ. Traditional Christian teaching has always assumed there is a contest between God and Satan, that God has been trying desperately to get the world saved. In other words, God had sent Jesus Christ at his first coming to try to win this ongoing war against Satan. Traditional Christianity has taught that whosoever will may come and be saved through Jesus. For many years, Mr. Armstrong partially realized the error of this assumption, but the full truth on this point did not come crystal clear to his mind until the last few years of his life. This truth, fully explained in Mystery of the Ages, is indeed mind-boggling. This book clears what has been fully clouded in mystery. It will open your eyes to the truth of these long-hidden mysteries. This enlightening volume thoroughly explains precisely what the Bible says about the seven great mysteries of life. It is free upon request. For more, visit thetrumpet.com. Trumpet Daily.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back. The last days, the end time, Armageddon. Many journalists have evoked these terms in recent years to emphasize how dire conditions are in our world. We see nuclear proliferation, terrorism, weapons of mass destruction, disease outbreaks, weather disasters, arms races, moral decay, economic implosion. Study the facts on any of these threats, and you yourself may actually begin to wonder, am I living in the last days? Why do people so commonly mention those phrases, the last days, the end of time? Many people use these terms disparagingly. But where did these concepts even come from in the first place? The reason people use these terms to describe modern global catastrophes is because the Bible uses these terms to describe modern global catastrophes. Now, most people who toss these terms about don't read or believe the Bible, but the fact remains, when journalists take an honest look at the world around us, what they see is strikingly similar to what's described in the Bible. So, is it possible? Could we be living in the last days? Are we actually living in the last days described by the Bible? Most people would immediately answer, surely not. And some of the evidence that they might put forward would be, well, we've never seen any supernatural heavenly signs, or we've not yet heard the voice of God thundering from the heavens. This generation, they might say, has not even experienced a world war. So, because the biblical tribulation has not happened yet, neither is it about to happen. That's what many people assume. But let's step back and just broaden the scope and look at what's been happening in our world just in the last decade or so. Back in 2004, there was the devastating earthquake and the massive tsunami that killed 230,000 people in Indonesia. It's easy for us to carry on with our lives and to forget about that. But Indonesia hasn't forgotten. The year after that, in 2005, Hurricane Katrina plowed into the United States. And of course, the U.S. is a first world country, supposedly immune to so much suffering. And that killed 1,800 people. In 2006, switching over to the Middle East, the powder keg of the world, really, in so many ways. It erupted in war. Israel warred against Hezbollah in Lebanon. And then the following year, you had Hamas and Fatah go to war with each other and then turn their sights on Israel. Israel that year, 2007, remember, bombed Syria's nuclear facility. And some analysts said that that strike nearly started World War III. In 2008, there was an earthquake in China that killed close to 70,000 people. I mean, that's another breathtaking loss of human life. That same year, Russia invaded Georgia. Iran conquered Lebanon. Germany conquered Kosovo. The United States, remember, deposed the leader of Pakistan, a nuclear-armed country. Of course, the biggest news in 2008 was the U.S. economy coming within just a few minutes of a total meltdown. The New York Post said the market was just 500 trades away from Armageddon. There's that term again. According to the New York Times, the American financial system was sliding from grim toward potentially apocalyptic. That's not the Bible describing those events. Again, these are journalists, these are newsmen, describing the events of 2008. Now, since that time, America has tried to keep itself afloat by borrowing and printing trillions of dollars, and all the other world economies tied to the fate of America are watching nervously. In 2009, the European Union adopted the Lisbon Treaty as its new constitution, and then it immediately plunged into an economic crisis. And since then, what have we seen in Europe? We've seen Germany rise as the dominant economic and now political force on the entire continent. In 2010, just as we have been predicting for so many years, Iraq fell to Iran. That same year, the U.S. dollar came under assault. And America, since that time, really, it was happening before 2010, but that year in particular, we really saw the relationship between America and Israel just fall apart. And today, in 2015, it's much worse. Britain also, back then, surrendered its military sovereignty. That same year, 2010, the Associated Press called that year the year that the earth struck back, just because of all of the so-called natural disasters. You had the worst flooding in Australian history, a biblical disaster, according to the Courier Mail in Brisbane, and then another devastating earthquake in New Zealand. You had the tsunami in Japan that killed almost 16,000 people. You had the American South getting hit by a wave of tornadoes. In one case, there were 312 tornadoes in just one day. Just one day, that was more than double the previous record. In 2011, if you remember all the coverage at thetrumpet.com and in our Trumpet magazine, the bloody Arab Spring that was just tossing governments out the door across the Middle East and North Africa. Iran's position in the region just growing stronger and stronger. In 2012, the European Union hit Iran with an oil embargo. Tensions between these two powers have been building even up to this day, where you have the recent terrorist attack in France. Tensions have been building. Of course, who can forget the attack on the American compound in Benghazi? A shameful, shameful response from America in return. Really, no response. That same year, North Korea successfully launched a rocket into orbit. There were more mass shootings in America. In 2013, North Korea tested another nuclear bomb. Revelations about America's surveillance programs started pouring out. Terrorists killed 70 people at a mall in Kenya. Terrorists bombed the Boston Marathon. A killer murders a dozen people at the Washington Navy Yard. And then last year, 2014, we heard all about ISIS rising in Iraq and Syria, actually announcing itself a caliphate. Russia annexed Crimea. They shot down the passenger jet just last summer. Remember that over the Ukraine? The U.S. Opens diplomatic relations with Cuba, of all nations. And then more recently, here in Britain, the U.K., Scotland, just very nearly voted to dismember the United Kingdom from the inside out. And just more generally speaking, throughout this past decade, we've seen a handful of trends continue unabated. The spread of terrorism, for example. The rise of Iran. The rise of Germany. The political coercion by the Catholic Church. The moral, economic, and political weakening of Britain. The Commonwealth. Of course, the United States. So as I say, there's nothing really to debate here. It's just a basic timeline of facts. But the question is, are these normal times in which we are living? Or are we living in what the Bible calls the last days? And the Bible is a fascinating book. Its writings have lasted for millennia. And the entire Western world is linked to the Bible on some level or another. This is a book that has changed lives. It's a book that's shaped history. You just think about some of these things. I mean, surely the Bible, we've talked about this in recent programs, but it's the most unusual and unique book in world history to have been compiled over centuries by all these different authors in all these different circumstances and in different languages to have a unified message throughout and to be so influential among so many nations, nations that aren't even Hebrew-speaking nations or Greek-speaking nations in the case of the New Testament. I mean, there's something about this book that's incredibly unique and powerful. Now, maybe you think it's all just thousands of years of happenstance and superstition. But what if it isn't? Among those who do view the Bible positively, many don't actually read it. Few will venture into its prophecies, even though you have to cut off a third of the entire book. If you don't read prophecy, then a third of the book is out the window. And then what about the commandments of the book, the laws of the Bible? Few people will ever let the Bible dictate to them what is right and what is wrong in their lives. But many people do at least recognize the temporary nature of human life, and they recognize that we human beings commit evil actions. They see it. We see it. Everyone sees it. We see it on the news. And many people recognize a need for salvation. And some of them even recognize that salvation is in the teachings of Jesus Christ. Even if you're not among those, you have to admit that basic fundamental foundations of our Western society are inextricably tied to the Bible and to the revolutionary teachings Jesus Christ brought to this earth 2,000 years ago. The supremacy of law, the judicial system, morality, virtues, the elemental role of family, the entire idea of human relationships depending on a higher law rather than force. It's all tied to this book. It's all tied to that man that proclaimed a message about family, a message about a soon coming kingdom. And it's this man, this Son of God, as he said, who talked about the end of days. It's this man, Jesus Christ, that spent so much of his ministry projecting ahead, projecting forward, telling his disciples about the end of this age and the beginning of a new age. This is not some wild-eyed prophet that nobody took seriously. Jesus Christ spoke about the very days that we're living in right now. We'll show you more on that when we come back.
Are we living in the last days? Some dismiss the notion as fanatical. But world leaders and news analysts are issuing warnings that are becoming more and more dire. Could Bible prophecies about the last days actually be accurate? Our brochure can help guide you through the relevant news and history and help you compare these events to what the Bible says. Are we living in the last days? This brochure is available for free right now at thetrumpet.com.
So let's look at the Bible to see what Jesus Christ said about this time period, the days that we're living in right now. We're going to begin in Luke 21, and as we read through some of these verses, and again, please read along, but as we read through some of these verses, you compare it to some of the things that you see on the evening news or that you read about on your news app or on the internet. Compare it to what's happening in your world. This is Luke 21, beginning in verse 28, it says, and when those things begin to come to pass, then look up and lift up your heads, for your redemption draws near. So here Jesus Christ is forecasting that he would return. And notice he's telling his disciples to look for certain things. When these things come to pass, when you see these things happen, then you'll know that we're getting close. Now, he didn't mean for us to know the exact day or the hour, but he certainly meant for us to anticipate this event, the greatest event in the history of the universe. I mean, and again, this is coming from Jesus Christ. So many people in the religious world just look at Jesus Christ only as a sacrifice. They don't see him as a great prophet. They don't see him as one that prophesied of the end time, that prophesied of these days that we're living in right now. Let's just look over at 2 Timothy chapter 3. 2 Timothy 3. It's amazing when you think about what Jesus said there in Luke 21, or you compare it to the companion passage in Matthew 24. You put it together with what the Apostle Paul said over here in 2 Timothy chapter 3, and we'll start in verse 1. It says, "This know also, that in the last days perilous times shall come." Perilous or dangerous times would come in the last days. Now, don't let some quiet little neighborhood that maybe you live in fool you. Again, you have to keep your eyes open and watch. Watch and pray, as Jesus said. And if you're watching, then you see that danger is spreading, that the perilous days that Timothy or that Paul talked to Timothy about here, we're living in them. Let me just take you to a quote from Herbert Armstrong. This is in a booklet that he wrote titled, "Are We in the Last Days?" And we're going to offer you this later on in the program. He said this, "This is a prophecy, as it plainly states, for the last days." He's talking about this prophecy in 2 Timothy. "When I was a little boy," he writes, 90 years ago, "those conditions were not true or escalating as they have been within the last 20 or 30 years. Now, he's writing this back in the mid-1980s. He says, "The weapons have never existed in all history that could have laid all cities waste until the hydrogen bomb of some 30 years ago." He says, "How significant that this became possible only during the time while this gospel of the kingdom was going from nation to nation into all the world for a witness to all nations." He's talking about a prophecy in Matthew 24 and the significance of how that when that message was going out around the world, that at the same time you had the technology emerge that allowed man to actually kill off the human race. Because if you look at that prophecy, I don't know if we'll have time to go over there, in Matthew 24, if you look at that prophecy, you see that it's going to take God's divine intervention to stop man from destroying himself. That's what it says over in Matthew 24. Let's stay here, though, in 2 Timothy and read verse 2. It says, "For men shall be lovers of their own selves, covetous, boasters, proud, blasphemers, disobedient to parents, unthankful, unholy." Paul is describing human nature. I mean, it's always been this way in a sense. But as he brings out in this passage, one thing that you can look for in these latter days is you can look for human nature to just get worse and worse and worse. And we certainly have seen that. You compare this with other passages in the Bible. Jeremiah 17 comes to mind, just about the sick nature of the human mind, human nature in all of its ugly colors, described here in 2 Timothy 3, verse 3. He says, "Without natural affection, truce breakers, false accusers, incontinent, fierce, despisers of those that are good." See, without even the natural kind of affection that you would expect there to be between spouses or within families, even that is disappearing. There's so much division and variance and hatred and strife, even down to individual households, families. Certainly you see it between nations, between religions. You see it in You see it in Britain today. You see it in the United States today. Verse 4 says, traitors, heady, high-minded, lovers of pleasures more than lovers of God, having a form of godliness, but denying the power thereof, from such turn away. This is a perfect description of our world today. There may be an outward show of goodness here and there, or an outward show of religious living. But look beneath the surface. Where do you see in society today the Bible or God having authority over our lives, over our nations, over our families? So many people, even those that claim to be religious, will at the very same time deny, as it says here, the authority of the Bible and reject the prophecies about Christ's return, for example. We see so much of that. This world's filled with churches, and yet, where do you hear the true message that Jesus Christ proclaimed about the soon coming kingdom of God? Where do you hear it? You just don't hear it today. Here he goes on down in verse 7, ever learning and never able to come to the knowledge of the truth. That word ever means at all times. I mean, just always learning, one generation after another. And here in these last few generations, we've seen this tremendous upsurge in materialistic knowledge, an explosion of knowledge. And yet, right along with it, you see mankind drifting further and further from the truth. You see these dangerous times intensifying, perilous days. That's the great paradox that Mr. Armstrong often talked about. That's the great paradox that he talks about in that little booklet, Are We in the Last Days? The fact that you have this explosion of knowledge and this explosion simultaneously of violence and division and strife. Down in verse 13, he says, but evil men and seducers shall wax worse and worse, deceiving and being deceived. See, that's where it talks about it just intensifying, worsening as we draw closer to the end of this age. I mean, this is describing our day today. People can go and bury their heads in the sand if they choose, but this is an apt description of the society around you. Let's just go over to Matthew 24, see if we have enough time to squeeze in a few more verses from what Jesus himself said. Matthew 24, as I said, this is a good companion chapter to what we read over in Luke just a moment ago. We'll start in verse 3. Matthew 24, verse 3, it says, and as he sat upon the Mount of Olives, the disciples came unto him privately, saying, tell us, when shall these things be, and what shall be the sign of your coming and of the end of this world? Tell us. Tell us when these things are going to unfold. Give us a sign. Show us when the end of this world comes. Now, they weren't asking there about the end of this earth physically or the destruction of the earth. Some scientists will warn about that. The Bible doesn't. The Bible talks about the end of this age, of man's rule over man, of Satan's rule over this earth. The Bible does definitely talk about that coming to an end. Jesus himself, as I said, a great prophet, did prophesy about the destruction of this age. Not the destruction of all humankind, although in this passage down in verse 22, it does say that we get awfully close to that. I mean, that's a frightening thing to think on, what it says there in Matthew chapter 24. But you go back to what the disciples are inquiring about here. Jesus had every opportunity. He had every opportunity to stop the disciples right in their tracks, right then and there, and to say, look, hey, don't get so caught up in prophecy. I mean, just look at me as the sacrifice. Just talk about a message of love and peace, and that's it. Instead, he goes on and answers their question. And he gives them a specific listing of events. You look for this to happen before I return to this earth. You watch for this. And God's disciples, Christ's disciples today, follow that same trajectory. They're watching world events. He says in verse 4, and Jesus answered and said unto them, take heed that no man deceive you, for many shall come in my name, saying, I am Christ, and shall deceive many. This is talking about that first horseman of the apocalypse. It's talking about religious deception. Many would come and deceive many millions of people, deceive them about the truth. Verse 14 is this verse that Mr. Armstrong referred to about the gospel going out. It says, and this gospel of the kingdom shall be preached in all the world for a witness unto all nations, and then shall the end come. See, the end. The end, in this case, is talking about the end of a work or an era, not the end of this age of man, as it talks about in verse 3. The gospel would go out to all the world, and then that era would end, and a new era would come on the scene, a Laodicean era, as it's called in Revelation 3, an era of lukewarmness, an era where most of God's people fall away from the truth and turn to these other pagan ideas, deceptions, false doctrines, heresy. Down in verse 21, it says, for then shall be great tribulation, such as was not since the beginning of the world to this time, no, nor ever shall be. And then it says, and except those days should be shortened, there should no flesh be saved, but for the elect's sake, those days shall be shortened. Let me just conclude with one quote from Are We in the Last Days? God is not going to intervene or send Jesus Christ to set up a better civilization and the wonderful, happy, peace-loving world tomorrow until humanity and its leaders have had to admit their utter failure in providing peaceful, happy, and useful lives on this earth. It says, even today, most people in the Western world do not want to hear much about God. They want God to keep himself out of their lives. Well, God's about to put himself right in the center of things, but only after man learns this lesson and sees the futility of human reasoning. We'll offer you this booklet here at the end of the program, but that's all the time that we have to go into this subject. There's much, much more to study, so be sure that you listen to all of the information coming up here and request the literature that we have offered today. Thanks for joining us, and we'll see you next time.